Welcome to Mound Money on this first day of November. I mean, last week of April. Holy cows, Larry, we got a lot of snow out there.
Indeed. Well, we're going to have our last show in April under snow, and a good chance of snow, 70% chance the rest of today, declining to 20% tomorrow, and then bright sunshine tomorrow, but still pretty chilly. Anyway, let's get on to the business at hand, which is Mountain Money. And our first guest today is Dick Cross. Dick Cross is something of a turnaround artist. He takes companies that need help and works to get them turned around. And in the course of that, he's been a CEO of many companies and has written a book, 60-Minute CEO, Mastering Leadership. So we're going to talk to him about that.
And then we're going to go local and talk to a local CEO who's been running his company for 30 years. We all know the name, Jess Reed. We see the name around town. Jess Reed Real Estate is celebrating 30 years in the business, and I understand that makes him his firm the longest running continuous real estate broker here in town. So we're going to hear more about, we're going to interview Jess, and we're going to hear more about his story. And then our last guest is going to be David Dean Zimmerman. She is the owner of David Dean Quilt Shop. And Larry, I didn't know that there were quilt shops, but
Are you kidding? This is Utah. This is a hotbed of quilting.
All right. Well, we're going to find out how hot the hotbed of quilting is from David Dean. I look forward to hearing more about what a quilt shop is and the services and products they offer. You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a minute. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
I'm Monica Simos of the Park City High School Minor Detail Show, informing you of current events at the high school and in the community every Saturday from 7 to 8 p.m. Tune in Saturday nights or listen online at kpcw.org and like our Minor Details Facebook page.
Brought to you by Rich Fine Realtor, UPS Stores, and Elliott Work Group.
And welcome back to Mound Money. We are working to get Dick get Dick Cross on the air with us. So, Larry, while we're waiting for Dick, as you know, the labor number comes out this Friday for nationwide. But I'm looking at the last report from Utah, and Utah continues to do well. Percent change, the improvement was 2.8%, and the unemployment rate fell to 4.1%, which is actually quite low, so good for Utah.
Well, I think that puts us up there with North Dakota, again, for one of the best employment rates.
I was not expecting you to say North Dakota, but I guess with all the oil shale work going on now, North Dakota's a hot...
That's the lowest unemployment in the country, and I think we're second. So
really?
We're somewhere in the top five.
I think the government here in Utah gets a pat on the back for that. They are very pro-business. They do a lot of things to generate new jobs here in the state. So congratulations to the leaders here in the state of Utah for having those successes.
Yes. So we have Dick Cross on the line with us now. Dick has worked with underperforming companies for more than a quarter of a century, helping mainstream businesses achieve their next level of success. And in the course of that, he's been CEO or president of nine of those companies and mentored more than 100 CEOs in his career. His undergrad degree is in architecture at the University of Virginia, but then went on to Harvard and Master of Science from Columbia, lives on the East Coast. And welcome, Dick Cross.
Hey, is this Larry or is this Doug?
This is Larry, and Doug is going to ask the next question, but let me ask the first one. Just give us a little background. How does one become a kind of CEO for hire?
You know, it was just you know, I think so much if we let our paths unfold in front of us, they'll lead us in a good direction. That's what happened to me. I came out of business school, got hired by some great old Harvard Business School profs. I followed them around, and I say carried their bags and watched them fix companies, and started my own consulting firm, working mostly for financial sponsors. And eventually they started saying, well, look, why don't you just come and run this thing rather than tell us how to fix it? And that's how it all got started.
Okay, and you say really there are two things about running a business, thinking and attention to personal character. Why don't you just expound on that notion briefly?
Well, you know, I do a lot of keynote speeches on the heels of the second book, and I find audiences sort of drop their jaw when I say running a company is not really a full-time job. There are really two things you have to do, and so few people pay any conscious attention to them. But I find over and over again that if I spend an hour, three times a week, thinking about my business, thinking assiduously about my business, and what that means for me is, what is my business today, and does it make as much sense as it did last year or the year before? And where is it today? Where does it need to be? And my responsibility is, how am I going to get it there? But spending time alone thinking hard about that is half the job. And the first book, Just Run It, has a lot of tools and frameworks that are kind of fun to use for that exercise. And the other part of it is thinking hard about how you handle yourself and the character that you display. Because in addition to the logic for your business that comes out of the thinking part, the nitrous oxide, the accelerant, is if you handle yourself in such a way that people really, really want to help you get done what you want to get done for your business.
Yeah, I think the character piece is a big part of this. And one of the things I tell young people when they're in a position where they're running a company for the first time, more often than not, the folks I'm talking to are folks that have started their own company. They start to get some success. They're recruiting teams. They're starting to grow. And they're starting to raise capital for the first time. You mentioned financial partners. I expect what you meant by that was really the private equity folks that have bought into the company, and now there's bumps in the road and are bringing you in to help them with that. But getting back to the entrepreneur and the CEO, one of the things I tell them is to be authentic and to be themselves. People have this image of who they think a CEO is supposed to be, and sometimes they move away from the core of who they are. And ironically, in trying to be more successful as a CEO, they make their job harder and they're less likely to succeed.
100%. I'm with you 100%. I'm now in my second private equity partnership, so I've been on both sides. And, you know, unfortunately, I also have taught a lot. I developed a mid-year presence course at Harvard. But I have yet to find a business school curriculum or a curriculum in any school that is called How Do You Run a Business? And the model that most everybody has in mind is the model that all of young America imprinted on in the 1940s in the Second World War, and that was the command and control model, and lo and behold, we won a war with it. But those men and women, young men and women, came home and ran their families according to that model, ran businesses according to passed it on to the next generation. And we're at the first time we're four generations away from that the particularly the millennials, but a lot of the Ys and certainly the nexters are saying, you know what, that's just not what we want to do, and it takes an entirely different demeanor and character at the top of an organization to inspire their followership. And you're right, one of the anchor points is authenticity, and in 60 Minutes CEO, there's a whole chapter on that particular title. But, you know, the workforce today is so attuned that they spot a phony in a minute. And the difficult part of that is that if you're the phony, you're the one, you think you're getting away with it. But what's actually happening is your organization is giving you far less than what they could if, in fact, they respected you, they admired you, and word we don't use enough, is they loved you and wanted to help you succeed, wanted to be part of your parade.
Well, the phony part's is really a two-edged sword. What I've found with entrepreneurs is they're not as happy. They're not enjoying the experience of running their company as much as they could be if they were being true to themselves. So it's a negative experience for the entrepreneur. It's also a negative experience, as you point out, for the team, because the team knows, hey, there's something inconsistent between what I see maybe socially or, you know, outside of work and what I'm seeing in work. And that inconsistency causes stress because people want to feel comfortable and confident in their leaders, and they lose that when they see inconsistency with them.
You're exactly right. And the unfortunate, well, after 2.5 decades, if there's any single characteristic, psychological characteristic, I can observe across now 150 CEOs, when you peel the onion, what they are is they are scared. They are scared that somebody's going to find out they don't know what they're doing in their job. And everybody kind of does it differently, and there are very few guidelines or models for how to do that job at the top, which is unique in the organization.
Now Dick, don't you also find, too, sometimes at the top, overconfidence? So there's guys that maybe should be scared, but they're not scared.
When things are going well. But honest to goodness, that's a temporary and a false sense of bravado. And I find very few people, even when things are going well, that can't wait to get to that board meeting, can't wait to get in front of that investor group and tell them the story about their business, even though it might have some bad points, and have no compunction walking in and saying, you know what, we would have had a heck of a lot better month this month if I hadn't goofed up on this point, but here's what we're doing to take care of it.
So what does that process look like for you? Let's say here locally there's, you know, a company that has had some success, and now a new competitor's come in, or the recession hits, and now they're going through a tough patch. And they bring you in and say, "Hey, Dick, give us some advice. Help us through this period of time." What does that process look like for you?
It involves becoming the head listener rather than an answer guy for a long period of time. I think it's a disservice to believe that you can come in and without really spending some time to understand a business, tell people what is the right thing to do, what's going to get them out of the ditch. I find that asking questions, continuing to ask questions, continuing to peel the onion, leads people to own understanding of what needs to be done.
Yeah, you know, you've parachuted into any number of companies to help fix things. Is there any one thing that's central to fixing all companies? I mean, how, if you've done this so many times, how can you possibly know about all these businesses you're coming in to help fix? Does it not matter if they sell software or farm implements?
I've done everything from software to all kinds of manufacturing, and I don't pretend to know well the businesses that I have taken over. What I do know is how to do the job at the top, and that is fungible across any business. There is a certain set of tools, a certain set of perspectives, a certain set of way of handling yourself at the top that always works. And that's why my tenures are sort of short. I will spend from 9 months to maybe 2 or 3 years max with a company, because once I get it headed in the right direction, establish the culture and have the strategy set and have execution started, someone else needs to come in who really understands the details of the business. If I'm there in 1.5 years, yeah, I get to the point where I can talk enough about the specifics of the business to get through a conversation with just about anybody, a customer or supplier. But at that point, somebody needs to come in. I think of my role as kind of like a jeweler that takes an old piece of jewelry, say it's a ring, and I will rebuild the setting for the new stone. And that's kind of my job. But the reason I wrote the first book was because, quite frankly, I couldn't find anybody who could answer the question. I've asked now 10,000 people in keynotes, basically. How do you run a business? And everybody kind of, deer in the headlights, don't know the answer to that.
So let me play devil's advocate here, because in the green room ahead of time, I asked Larry that. I told Larry that, hey, Dick is going to ask you this question, because in reading your foreword, I could see that coming. And I asked Larry, who unfortunately just had to step out of the room, how do you run a company? When Larry comes back, I'm going to have him share his answer. with you. But while we're waiting for Larry to come back in, let me go back to a previous point that you mentioned. Earlier, you were talking about kind of the keys to running a company, and what I heard you say was really culture, strategy, and execution. And when you were talking about carrying the luggage bags for the Harvard professors, Harvard's a pretty good business school, and those sound like three key components that you would hear about in most Harvard Business School classes. So why do you think your framework is different than what folks are being taught in business schools?
Well, I think because it's an inside-out idea of how you run a company. You have to be confident and have your own thinking figured out on the inside and then let it spill out to people rather than believe that all the answers are on the outside. It's the interplay of the two. But
so it would really be that internal focus versus an external focus is where you see your approach being differentiated.
Yeah, I'm firmly of the opinion that running a company well is an inside job, and unless you get that right, you will never have the level of comfort, the degree of ability to look critically at decisions you've made, things that the company's already doing, and make sure that they're right or wrong, and also project yourself in a way that that develops zealous followership.
Yeah, now, Dick, I agree with you on the point that some of the inside skills are the harder ones to learn, and those are ones that we don't talk about as often. Strategy is fun to talk about, right? Talk about your competitors, you talk about your products, you talk about distribution. Execution is really, really hard, which is an inside skill. Culture is really, really hard, which is an inside skill. And some of the best classes I took in business school, though, were the ones where we really learned by the case study. So here's a situation. Here's what the entrepreneur went through. And in some cases, these entrepreneurs were guys like – I was fortunate to go to Stanford Business School. They were guys like Andy Grove. And he said,
oh, yeah.
You know, here is how Intel faced the decision on whether we should focus more on memory storage or CPUs. And here's the background at that pivotal point before Intel was the Intel we know them today. And talk about that decision-making process. So I agree the inside is harder to learn and is important, but I do think it's being talked about in the business schools today. But would you disagree with that?
No, not at all. And I'll tell you, your internal compass as you develop as a CEO over your career is quite frankly the collection of stories that you either have lived through or, in fact, have heard other people tell you about. And it's that collection of stories that builds up over time to a point where you're not afraid to mistake. You're not afraid to admit it if you're the only one. And, in fact, you get to the point where you just are confident you're never going to run into a circumstance that you can handle. But it all starts with the ability by yourself to think hard and deeply about your business, to handle yourself and put people maniacal in your support.
So let's sign up for some brief therapy here and some free consulting advice while we have you. So, Larry, I don't want to put you on the spot, but it is a question I asked a half hour ago in the green room, so you've had some time to think about it. You're the general manager here at KPCW. You're running a business.
Uh-oh.
And I warned you Dick was going to ask you the question, you know, how do you run a business? And you're running a business. And I thought the answer you gave was great. Share it with Dick and see if there's any feedback from Dick that he thinks we should add to or take away from.
Well, I guess it's universal how I would see running a business, and I've run 75 person newsrooms before too, and it's have a vision, know where you want to go, and be able to communicate that, and then B, hire good people to take you there, and give them free rein to pretty much do what they see fit to get you to the goal, and then, of course, just monitor them as you go. And
it sounds like a reasonable
answer. Formula I know, and I don't know if it's the right formula, but it works for me.
So, Dick, what would you add to that? What kind of advice or consulting would you give to somebody in Larry's situation?
I think we are very much on the same wavelength. I have a little bit different set of words that I use to describe it and sort of a visual model in my head that I use, but it touches all of those points. And I think that it starts with the word I use is vision, and that is having a set of core values and a sense of purpose for your organization that inspires people and having a next step that you're trying to achieve that walks the knife edge between something you just might. Yeah, most people say, we can't do that. But if you get yourself, you got a good chance to do it. And the vision leads into strategy. And I started life as a strategist and writing big, fat books. But now, based upon solid clarity of vision, strategy can, I tell people, if you can't write strategy in 5 bullet points on one side of an index card, you just haven't thought about it hard enough. And then execution is assembling the people and the other resources. Get the strategies done, and making sure that everybody understands that logic. That's kind of the overarching framework.
Well, Dick, that's a good summary of the main principles in your book. And one of the things I like about the theme in your book is it's not as hard as people make it out to be a successful CEO, and that's encouraging and it's inspiring. And I think entrepreneurship and for folks that think that they want to run their own business – boy, the bigger risk of people are afraid of failing, but I would argue that the bigger risk is they should be very fearful of having regret later in their life if they don't give it a shot. And so thank you for those closing inspiring words. Our guest this morning is Dick Cross. He is the author of The 60-Minute CEO. It's an easy read. There's some great advice in there. Dick, thank you for joining us this morning.
It's all my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Dick. And again, I mentioned the forecast includes snow continuing throughout the day, a 70% chance. Of course, it's a 0% chance now, but there are more clouds rolling in all afternoon, making way to sunny skies tomorrow, a low of 22 tonight. So cover your crocuses if any of them have come through. And we will be back to talk about the quilting business. After this.
This is Sean Railton. I'm an agent with Park City Realty Group. I'm a 30-year Park City resident and a KPCW underwriter. I have been involved in the Park City real estate market since 1994 as an agent, an appraiser, and an investor. I can be reached at 649-1991 or Sean at parkcityrealtygroup.com.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Interesting conversation with Dick Cross there. And as I closed on that interview, talking about the power of inspiring people to go out and follow their dreams, our next guest in the studio is David Dean Zimmerman, and she did just that. She followed her dream. She is the owner of David Dean Quilt Shop. David Dean, welcome to the studio. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Doug, for having me here today.
So I don't know if you're listening at the top of the hour, but I shared on air that I didn't know that there were quilt shops. So what is a quilt shop?
Our quilt shop, which is similar to many along the Wasatch Front, sells fabric and notions and all the tools that you need to make a quilt. And then we have lots of classes, several classes a week that you can come and we teach you how to make your own quilt.
Okay. This is kind of a hotbed of quilting, isn't it, Utah?
Yes, it is. It's very big in Utah. We're happy to be a part of that.
So my 11-year-old daughter this time of year actually usually takes a sewing class, and she goes to what I would call a fabric store.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so your store is similar to what a fabric store would be, but really focused more on quilting as opposed to using cloth and sewing.
Yes, that's right.
Do you do both or is it just quilting?
We do a little bit of clothing like girl skirts, and then we do a lot of purses and bags and pillows, but it is mostly quilts.
Okay.
And table toppers, table runners, art. Quilt art that you can hang on your wall.
So when I think of quilts, I think of, and growing up Amish, you know, you see the room with the women all hand sewing. But I know now there's automated equipment. In fact, one of the market leaders in automating these quilting machines is based here in Utah, and it sounds like there might be a couple of those. Are most people quilting using this machinery, or are they doing hand sewing?
Yes, they're called long-arm machines. There's also mid-arm, and then you can also quilt on your own home machine, your domestic machine, and we even teach people how to quilt on their own machine. There's still some quilters out there that love to hand quilt, but most of the quilts that we're seeing are done on the long arm.
And do most people have their own long arm or medium arm at home, or is that they come to your shop in order to use your equipment to do that?
They don't use our long arm at our shop, but we have a long arm quilter who you can drop your quilts off there, and she has a 1 week turnaround.
That kind of takes away the fun of quilting, right? Because now somebody else is doing the quilting as opposed to you, or am I missing that?
Well, it's the piecing that's fun, the design of it.
Okay.
And then, like I say, a lot of people can quilt their own on their own home machine. They don't need to buy a long arm. But having a long arm is very fun. It's a very fun to do.
Are they expensive for somebody to have at home, the long arm quilting machine?
Yeah, they are. They can get up more expensive than a car. And
wow. It's like mountain biking.
That gets to be an expensive bedspread.
Yeah, so if you're going to own a long arm, you need to do a lot of quilting or do a lot of quilting for other people to pay for it.
Now, quilting used to be a social thing, probably still is, but it used to be gathering. You have to stretch the quilt out on a big frame, you know, the size of the quilt, so it's rather large object. So I guess, first of all, you need a big room to do it in.
Yeah.
But it's ladies sitting around, generally ladies, maybe there are a few guys involved, but generally ladies sitting around a room, and it's a social thing. Quilt as you talk and talk as you quilt.
Our classes are that way. Each person brings their own sewing machine, and we have a good time in our classes. It's very social and fun, and each week we do different designs, different patterns.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I mentioned earlier my 11-year-old takes a sewing class about this time every year, and I'm always amazed. You know, she's got a sewing machine at home. She takes a class. She gets good at it. And, you know, if something needs to be sewn at home, my wife needs, you know, a pair of slacks hemmed or something like that, she'll quickly run it up to her room and get it done in a couple minutes. But she doesn't do any projects on her own. And I asked her about that. I said, you know how to sew. You like sewing. Why don't you do that? Well, that's what she said. She said, I only like to sew with my friends. It's a social thing. And Larry, as guys, maybe we don't I can see that, but it seems to me if you like
we
to sew.
We drink beer and watch football together.
That's our social thing. Or mountain biking and skiing in a town like Park City. So I suspect your shop not only just serves as having the products and services people need, but it's kind of a social gathering place like a coffee shop might be for other folks.
Yes. A lot of our customers know each other, and also they like to come in groups, come with friends, and so it's a very social time, a fun time to get to meet our customers, and it's a relaxing place to be. It's a cute shop and very bright, colorful. And
I was going to ask if you thought about that social aspect as you were designing the layout of the store, and it sounds like you have.
Yes, we have big, wide aisles, lots of room to gather. We put our classroom as part of the shop instead of closing it off into a separate room so that our customers can, you know, our class members can actually be out in the shop while they're sewing.
Okay.
So we have a big area to
Now, one of the things when my daughter's taking her sewing class is we all of a sudden have a plethora of all these homemade fabric. You know, we have more pillow. I have more new pillowcases this time of year and stuff like that. And the equipment and the hobby can be expensive. Fabric is expensive, as you mentioned. The equipment's expensive. Have online marketplaces like Etsy helped out with folks so that they don't have, if they don't want to go to a craft show to sell their goods, they can sell it online?
Yes, that's true. Most of our customers just make quilts for their family and friends and then just to make them because they love the design of it.
Right. Okay. And so most people are not doing it as a way to fund their hobby. They're doing it as a way to give gifts to people that they care about.
Yes.
So where's your store? Where's your shop?
It's in Silver Creek, right behind Sinclair Gas. Okay. So if you're on Highway 40, it's Exit 1. And if you're on Interstate 80, it's Exit 146.
So there's that,
and then you go north.
That shopping strip where there's initially they were kind of had tenants, and then the recession came and they lost some tenants, and it's like half filled. Is that where you're at, or is it?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. Okay.
There's Qual Paint over there and a new catering business over there.
Right.
And so hopefully some more retail will move in because not very many of the businesses there are retail right now.
Yeah.
But
they need something that drives foot traffic in there. I think that's what they're missing is something that where folks go to on a regular basis a couple times a week. Don't you think that's one of the things that's missing in that center right now?
Yes, yes.
So when did you move in there?
We're a destination shop.
Right. So something like yours, because that's a good question. How many quilting shops are there in the Park City area?
We are the only quilt shop in Summit County, and then there is one in Wasatch County. So the closest one east to us is Evanston, and
wow.
The closest one towards Salt Lake is in East Salt Lake.
And did you run a quilting shop before you opened this one?
You asked me when we moved here, and we moved here in October, and before that we were in Colville for a year. And I really appreciate the people of Colville giving us a start.
Right. Then do you still run the Colville location?
No, we moved here so that we could have a bigger demographic of customers.
Right. Population is a little bit higher here. And how's it going? Is it meeting your expectations?
Yes. We're doing really well. We're having a lot of fun. And could I just say something about our humanitarian?
Sure. Yes, please do.
Okay. This Wednesday night, we're inviting the community to come. We're donating all the fabric, and we would like the people to bring their sewing machines. And we're participating in 500 babies in Africa. And so we're doing quilts and diapers for the Zimbabwe.
Well, that sounds great. So as I mentioned, my 11-year-old has basic sewing skills. Is that something that somebody with basic sewing skills?
Yes.
In a sewing machine that, it's not top. I think it's a Brother sewing machine, just a regular sewing machine.
Oh, yeah. You just need a straight stitch.
And that's Wednesday night?
Yes.
At what time?
At 6.
Okay. And you guys are located behind the Sinclair gas station in that strip center there. Wednesday night. Our guest is David Dean Zimmerman. She's the owner of the David Dean Quilt Shop. Thank you for coming in.
Yes, thank you very much.
And when we come back, we're going to talk about a guy who had a lot to do with the modern Park City, Jess Reed, celebrating 30 years in the real estate biz. We'll talk with Jess after this.
Hi, this is Greg Cropper of Jones Waldo Park City, a Park City law office. I've been a big fan of KPCW since its first broadcast back in 1980. Jones Waldo has been representing clients from Summit and Wasatch counties since 1875. You can find us at joneswaldo.com.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau provides your business with lots of benefits, from business-to-business networking and promotional opportunities to access to our 1,000-plus membership database. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. Low Stump Tree Service, Park City's Local Tree Care, 435-200-5730. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Okay, welcome back. We should have a fun conversation now with Jess Reed, the legendary, the one and only Jess Reed, just wrapping up his 30th year in the real estate business in Park City, and everybody's seen your name on a building, on signs on for sale properties all around. And welcome back, and congratulations for surviving what has to be the most up and down business there is in this town.
Well, thank you. And it is crazy. And I'm here to say that I am still alive. You know, I went through the car wash out at the junction the other day, and the young guy took my credit card and he went, "Oh my God, I thought you were a dead guy. I've been driving by that building for 16 years and I didn't know it was anybody alive that was." And I went, "Well, that's not good for business, but so I'm alive."
Okay, there you heard it here that Jess is still alive and thriving in the real estate business. And take us back 30 years. And it's more than a handful, but there are probably not that many people left who remember the name Gumpeneers. That goes back 30 years, the big gorilla in real estate in the state of Utah and in Park City.
Actually, you're exactly right, and that was more like 35, 37 years ago. I came up in 1978 to work with Gumpeneers, manage our office here, which was considered, like the rest of Park City, a dead end. Most of my friends in Salt Lake couldn't understand why I'd taken this job to be the manager of this in this sleepy little town, that in the same type of town where the school district couldn't find a school teacher because it was considered a dead end then. But things have changed a lot.
Why'd you say yes back then?
Well, a lot of people go, "Boy, you were a visionary."
Yeah, exactly.
I was just kind of young and dumb, and I wanted to be in the mountains and ski and be closer than Salt Lake. Right. And I thought there was opportunity, and it all worked out very well for me. But, it was a different world back in those days here. It's come a long way.
So back 30 years ago, people hadn't really discovered Park City. So who were you selling to? A lot of Salt Lakers who saw an opportunity?
Our market was mostly Salt Lake. And you have to remember, most people can't remember back in those days, but our population here was only about 1,100 people, no stoplights, two beat up two-lane highways in and out of town. No Park Meadows existed, or it was just starting. Deer Valley didn't exist.
Were there any roundabouts back then?
No, there weren't.
It's roundabouts.
And we didn't usually stop for the stop signs either. But
and why is it that people from out of town can't figure out how to use a roundabout? It seems pretty intuitive to me. Am I the only one that has noticed that?
I figured it out.
I figured it out pretty quickly, too, but it seems like a lot of people that visit from out of town.
Well, this
cannot.
Is completely off topic,
it
but
is,
Jess
sorry.
Is just back from Europe. And let me tell you, going into a roundabout in Britain.
Or Paris.
Or where you're driving on the left, and then you enter a roundabout, panic sets
in. Yeah, that, yes. I can see where
that is a frightening thing. But
roundabouts here are just too small. That's what I think is the problem.
Yeah, but, yeah. Back to real estate. So you manage the Gumpeneer years, and that's when the Jack Nicklaus came to town, built a golf course at the behest of developers, the Racquet Club condos. went in, and it wasn't all success instantly, was it?
Well, it took off pretty fast. Our biggest obstacle, because we were selling Salt Lake in those days, was the Salt Lakers were worried about the drive and the gas mileage and the cost of gas. But we were also, we would sell out, Racquet Club condos would sell 50 of them in 24 hours with a waiting list, but we were selling them for $50,000.
So, Jess, let me ask you, because I think, you know, all of us have had experience with a realtor at some point in our lives, or if you're very young and you haven't, you're about to sometime soon. And it's a lot like going to a restaurant, right? You go into the restaurant, and because you're a customer there, you think you understand how the business works. So this is a business show, and I suspect my vision of how a successful real estate office works is very different than the reality. So what does it take to be, and you've succeeded here for 30 years, what does it take to be a successful realtor? In particular, now, I don't know the right term, what do you call it? You have realtors that work for you, and what you're
agents.
Like a, agents
real estate agents.
You. But
yes.
what is your role called in that hierarchy? You're not an agent. You're somebody that agents work for. What is that entity called?
At the real estate division, which you know regulates all licensees, I'm a principal broker.
Okay. So what does it take to succeed as a principal broker in the real estate industry?
Ooh. Well, I think to begin with, you need to be able to, you know, to run a business. But you also, it's good if you have been successful in sales in the past so that you can, because one of your key responsibilities is helping your real estate agents to put things together for transactions, to stay out of trouble, to
so
avoid
your coaching
legal issues.
And mentoring is a big part of your
huge
your
part
role.
Of it. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay. And helping them to stay up to speed on all the latest regulations and legal issues that we face all the time. Problem solving, because deals become so complex anymore, mm-hmm. and there's so much more legal involved than when I started in 1975 down in Salt Lake.
And do you think that is, so? I work in an industry that's very heavily regulated, and it is what it is. And so these are the rules, and you respect them. You know, some of my feedback in my industry is a lot of the regulation, unfortunately, does not inure to the benefit of what I think the regulators are trying to do, which is ultimately protect consumers. Do you feel most of the regulation in your industry is accomplishing that task of increasing transparency and protecting folks that maybe that don't have the knowledge base that folks that work in the industry do?
I would say yes.
I'm glad to hear that.
As opposed to what you're talking about, there's so many situations we face, and before we would have to create our own wording to deal with a complex issue, and now we have so many good forms that the agents can pull down on the computer. Well, this is this issue here, and
you know, it's funny you say that because as a consumer, as somebody that has used the services of real estate agents and mortgage brokers. Absolutely. In the last 20 years, as somebody that has moved and has had to buy and sell properties, the contracts are much more transparent. You don't have to be a contract attorney to understand what you're signing these days. So, yeah, I've definitely seen the impact of that.
Now, in real estate, it's a pretty much a different business model than the rest of the world in that your employees, your agents, you don't pay. You don't pay them. They have to generate sales, and then you share in the sales. How does that whole transaction work? I pay a 6% commission to sell a piece of real estate. Where does that money go?
Well, a good question, because it can become complicated. Typically, if I listed your house for sale and there was a 6% commission involved, and someone else, say another company, we cooperate with the other companies in the best interest of the client. Another company sells it, then right away half of it's gone to them to split up with their agent. Then we have the other half that goes, it's typically split between the company and the agent.
So 3% goes to Jess Reed Real Estate.
Yeah, and then we may also have, you know, referral fees that we may have paid to someone across the nation who referred the business to us. And that comes off the top, too. And then some companies may have franchise fees that come off the top, too, to pay the mothership of the franchise, for instance. And then you get done with that, and then you split that between the company and the agent.
So someone sees a, well, in this town, it could be $100,000 or more commission, and they must think, as I once did until I was straightened out, that whoever sells those deals, and they sell two or three or four a year, are just rolling in dough. Is that the case? I mean, are most realtors making a terrifically good income in this town?
I'd say most realtors, with the exception of a rare few, have struggled through the recession like every other business person I know, including myself. Now, as we're in a modest recovery, everybody's starting to do better, but it doesn't – you're right. It doesn't work that way. There are some large commissions, but there are large expenses that go along with it, from marketing and advertising to if you're a real estate agent, you're spending money every day, whether you're making a sale or not, just to be there, just to pay up fees to the boards, different boards of realtors, multiple listing services, on and on.
Well, and there's a lot involved in this, and I think the point I was going to make earlier, you know, I saw a trend 2005, 2006, early 2007, before the real estate market shut down. You started to see a fair number of for sale by owner signs pop up. Now, and then all of a sudden, every for sale sign was bank owned. It was kind of depressing, right? And now we're on the other side of that, and at least in this town, I don't see any for sale by owner signs. And I think that speaks to the amount of work it really takes. It sounds great, save yourself 6%, sell your house yourself. Do you think that trend has kind of come and gone, and people have tried that and seen, you know, it's not as easy as people think?
I'm not sure that it will ever go away. I think a lot of people are very intelligent and are capable of doing it, but what I remind them is it's time consuming, and you go through a lot of frustration when you do it. And so a lot of people try it, but ultimately will list their home with a broker. And especially here in Park City, we don't have as many for sale by owners because so many of the people that own property, something like 67% in the city, don't live here full time.
Really?
So that's
67% of the property
in the city
here?
Limits.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I would have guessed closer to 25%.
Oh, no. And then, you know, you get more resident, full-time residents out in the basin, you know. But either way, yes, it is complicated.
Out in the basin. We need to come up with a better term. It's, you know, that's kind of where I live, out in the basin. That does.
We could name you Snyderville City.
No, that doesn't sound good.
Everybody
either.
I know out there doesn't like that.
You're right.
Beverly Hills.
How about
Utah.
Like newer Park
La
City
La Land.
Or, I don't know, La La Land?
Well, so you have been just Reed Real Estate for 30-some years now, and you're not affiliated with a big brokerage, national brokerage. You're an independent, and does that – Why do you choose to stay independent when there are all these Prudential? Of course, Prudential is now about to become Berkshire Hathaway.
Right. Yeah.
But Prudential and Century 21 and Sotheby's and all of that. What's the advantage to you to stay your own self-contained brokerage?
I think there's a couple of things. Number one, in years past, I felt like that money I might be sending for the brand, I could use to promote the company more effectively here and support the agents locally, and as opposed to back then participating in ads in Kansas City or somewhere where it didn't help us that much. And also the fact that I had worked for the largest company in Utah, and we used to sit around and say, wow, with what we know now, you could go have a medium-sized boutique company and probably do just as well and make just as much money and have a lot more fun and focus on quality.
And but that's what you decide to set out and do, right?
That's what I did and have done. But what I haven't done a good job of is promoting that I am affiliated with Christie's International, which is the real estate section of the Christie's Art Auction.
And I was just going to bring that up. What does that add to what you can do?
Well, it's as things have changed in the real estate world, it's become more valuable, and I'm glad that I've realized that. I'm co-branding with them more and more. But that is the largest producing network of luxury home brokers in the world. And I just got back from Spain from the global conference over there, and it works. It's good for buyers and sellers as far as helping us to produce leads from sources that we might not meet here.
So you weren't just having fun in Europe. You were working there. We've only got time probably for one last question. I'm curious, legacy questions. Have you thought about the transition when you're no longer actively involved in the company? Do you have other family members? Do you have other brokers that you're thinking about transitioning into the leadership role, or what are you thinking there?
Well, I'm always looking for someone that would really be good to transition into the leadership role, but I'm very excited still about the future, especially having made it through World War III and the recession.
Yeah.
And so I've got a good number of years under my belt yet to go forward. And at some point in the future, though, yes, I will look forward to selling out and maybe working part-time there or just
But for
retiring.
Right now, you're enjoying it. You
Very
see a bright future
it, yeah.
and working forward. Well, good for you.
Having fun.
Yeah, Jess, congratulations. You've done so much for this community, and we don't have time to get into it, but we'll save that for another day. And those in the know how valuable Jess has been in building the brand of Park City. So thanks very much for joining us, and we'll be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
KPCW's new classified ads are now on Facebook. Join the Facebook group KPCW Classifieds and Ryborg and see what's being sold, hired, rented, and searched for today. Post what you're getting rid of or what you're looking for free. Another service for locals, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
And welcome back to Wrap Up Mountain Money. I'm really excited about, well, not that I wasn't this week, but excited about one of our guests next week. We have Adam Braun with us, and you may have seen him on all the morning talk shows or on the New York Times bestseller list. He has a book out called The Promise of a Pencil, and this is a young guy, Wall Streeter, who said, I don't need the Wall Street life. I'd really rather help people. And he works in schools and education programs around the world. And
I love stories like that, and I'm going to enjoy chatting with him.
And
I think our
and
listeners
he's
will
only,
enjoy
I don't even know if he's out of his 20s. He might be around 30. And,
yeah, you're and making me feel
making,
old, Larry.
Making waves. So he will be on the show next week. And I also want to thank our great sponsors, Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, Prudential Real Estate, San Francisco Design, and Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough. And in this time period tomorrow, Chris and Nell with This Green Earth. About a minute or two left. One thing that I don't think we have time to get into, so I'll save it for next week.
I've full-page scandal ads out of Salt Lake Tribune.
Another thing, full-page ad out of the Salt Lake Tribune, but there is just not enough time to get into that.
Not this week, but you're right. It's sad that stuff like that exists. I saw something this morning on television where it makes consumers think that if they qualify for SNAP, they get a free cell phone. And it's really a scam to get people to use the cell phone and go over the small number of minutes they get and start getting charged an exorbitant fee for the extra minutes.
And this one has a screaming headline, Cash in Limbo Goes to Residents in 27 Utah Counties. Well, that's every Utah County.
And a security guard holding
a
submachine guard in front of bags of money.
And it's all just absolute nonsense. Well, that wraps up Mountain Money for this morning. Thanks for listening. We sure appreciate it. And it's time now. KPCW Park City for NPR.